Our next guest sat down with retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, who shared his insights about the U.S.'s all-volunteer military. Eikenberry's observations and words of caution are the subject of a cover story in the National Journal written by James Bitfield, a contributing editor there. James, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
I want to start by going back to 1973 and President Nixon's announcement about the end of the draft. It was a very, very big deal at the time for a whole host of reasons. But set that up for you. What were the, you know, aside from maybe the political motivations, what were the issues with the draft, the conscription army?
Well, the political motivation was overriding. There were, you know, anti-war protests on college campuses. Those spread to major cities. There was a huge backlash against the war because of the outrage in all those localities. Congress launched a bunch of hearings that, looked very closely at the Vietnam War and why it wasn't going better, the Fulbright hearings. So there was this big backlash against the war, and Nixon wanted some way to ease the pressure, and his decision, the best way to do that would be to abolish the draft. So the, you know, sons and daughters of the middle class would no longer be drafted into this war that had become very unpopular. And there were some issues, too. The draft itself was not all that efficient. Lyndon Johnson never called up the National Guard or the Reserves, so they became sort of places where people who wanted to avoid the draft went. People got out of the draft. If you had a college deferment, so it automatically skews. So you get a deferment if you're, you know, if you have the wealth to go to college. So it wasn't altogether a perfect system, but the overriding decision was made because of the political consequences of trying to, you know, conduct from the White House a very unpopular war.
So was it a popular decision with the public at large, with politicians, with everybody?
Well, it was a popular decision because the backlash against the Vietnam War was so strong at that point, and it was so unpopular that I think everyone, you know, it passed overwhelmingly in Congress. The one group that really opposed it were the senior military leaders, who felt it was a terrible abandonment of them at their, you know, peak moment of vulnerability. People were literally in this country spitting on people in uniform, calling them baby killers and all of this. And at that moment, you make them go out there and recruit from one of the most anti-authoritarian generations in American history. So they felt it was a huge betrayal, but they didn't have the last say. And the president and secretary of defense decided to go ahead with it.
So what were those immediate consequences in terms of military forces? The draft ends, you're switching to an all-volunteer force. Was it phased in? And how did they adjust? How did the military adjust to it? And what were the implications of that?
Well, I mean, when it was proposed, you know, the Gates Commission was charged to look at the all-volunteer force, and it ultimately suggested that it, you know, the draft be abolished, raised some possible concerns that we should keep an eye on, that the military, would become so isolated from civil society that it would one day become a threat, you know, through a military coup, that you would have a permanent military underclass because it couldn't attract the best and the brightest. That you'd be a decline in public concern for foreign policy issues. There'd be an inclination for presidents to engage in military adventurism. And except for the underclass, all of those things actually came to pass. And a couple of things that they didn't anticipate have come to pass. We've now figured out that it's a very, very expensive force, and it has shifted dramatically the balance of power between the executive branch and the White House and Congress, because Congress hasn't declared war since World War II. So the presidents are free to use this all-volunteer force, much freer to use it than in past forces. So in the 70s, the idea of a permanent military underclass looked like it was going to happen. I mean, they had to scrape the bottom of the recruiting barrel for most of that decade. The participation of minorities who didn't have some of the opportunities that others in society have skyrocketed from, in African American, in the case of African Americans, from roughly 14% to 39% of the rank and file in the military. So a lot of the initial concerns started to come true. Now, with the Ronald Reagan's election in 1980 and the largest peacetime defense buildup, which lavished a lot of money on the all-volunteer force, which there was a new sort of spirit in America because I think of the hostage taking, that we, you know, it was still a dangerous world out there and we needed a strong military. all those things helped turn around the fortunes of the all-volunteer force until it became a very competent force. But a lot of the other concerns raised by the gate commissions continued to accumulate.
We've only got about a minute left before we have to go to the break, but one of the other consequences of was sort of a professionalism of the military force.
Right, and that's why, I mean, it's why you're not likely to see a return to the draft. Is this, you know, especially in an era of very high-tech weapons, we have a professional force that is in there to study the military arts, and for that reason, it's arguably, in some ways quantifiably, the most competent force we've ever had in uniform.
We're talking with James Bitfield. He is a contributing editor for the National Journal. He wrote a cover story that we're discussing called The Great Draft Dodge, Carl Eikenberry, and What Americans Lost When They Stopped Fighting.
And we want to hear from you. Are you or were you a military service member? Do these observations about the end of the draft, the rise of an all-volunteer military, ring true to you or not? Would we be better off with a draft, with a selective service system in action here in the United States? Why? Why not? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Yep, we'd like to hear from you. We'll continue our conversation. And if you'd like to contribute, give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls right after the news.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with James Bitfield. He's a contributing editor at the National Journal, and he wrote a cover story called The Great Draft Dodge, which examines the long-lasting impact that the end of the military draft has had on our nation.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think the U.S. should have an all-volunteer military, as it does, or bring back some form of draft? Why? Why not? Call now at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
I'd like to bring Carl Eikenberry into the discussion here and talk about his perspective a little bit, and maybe for the folks at home who might not be aware of him, a little bit about his background and why he is such an important voice in this discussion. James Bitfield, are you there?
Yes, I am. Well, I'm sorry, what was the question?
I wanted to bring Carl Eikenberry into the discussion for our listeners because he's an important voice in this discussion. Could you tell us a little bit about him and kind of his viewpoint, his take on this?
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought maybe you had him on the other line or something. You know, Carl Eikenberry led all U.S. forces in Afghanistan in the 2006-2007 time frame. So he got to see it from the senior U.S. commander's perspective. He went back in 2009 to 2011 and served as the top U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan. So he had a pretty unique perspective. He joins the Army out of West Point in 73, the very year that they had the all-volunteers went into effect. So he's seen the sort of progression and the evolution of the all-volunteer force sort of throughout his career, and got to see it in this really extraordinary time of the last decade where we've sent this all-volunteer force to fight, as I said, for more than a decade, in a way that was never intentioned by the architects of the all-volunteer force.
And Eikenberry is interesting because he did spend so much time in the military, and he started at that point, as you say, in the 70s, when it could be argued that the military and all conscription was at sort of a low point. He's seen ebbs and flows. At the same time, he is not advocating for the return of the draft right now.
No, I mean, for a number of reasons, I don't think anyone believes that there's any political constituency for a return to the draft. In large part because of what we said earlier, which is this is one of the most, if not the most competent force we may have ever fielded, because it's a force of professionals who join to, you know, learn the military arts, who stay in for longer times, who are more likely to reenlist. So a force of professionals, by its very nature, is going to have a level of competence that is going to be appealing to U.S. military leaders. For U.S. presidents, the fact that it's not tied to Congress by, you know, the need to call up conscription authority means it frees presidents to use it more freely. Congress seems perfectly happy to sit on the sidelines and not really get too engaged on these questions of the use of military force. So for all those reasons, there's really no backing for a return to the draft. the article is really an exploration of some of the unintended consequences of this new model of American warfare, that it really broke with two, you know, centuries of tradition of the citizen soldier fighting our wars.
And one of the things that it runs throughout the piece is this sort of lack of connection, either political or with the citizenry at large, with the military. It is a professional force, and it's not something that most of us deal with ever.
Right. I mean, we've, as I said, fought for two wars for a period of over 10 years, and less than 1% of the public has fought. And because as self-selected, those are not tend to be the sons and daughters of our political or cultural elite. They tend to be the working class kids of other soldiers or cops or teachers. So, instead of reinstating the draft as was originally anticipated, we sent the all-volunteer force off to fight for an extended time. We just sent this force back on back-to-back-to-back-to-back combat deployments. In other words, we kept reusing this very small force without growing it like it was anticipated to grow in an extended conflict. And that had huge repercussions on the health of the force, really astronomical levels of post-traumatic stress, which, you know, military psychologists will tell you every time you go back on a combat deployment, the possibility of that rises exponentially. Just huge, huge problems in the force. Suicide rates that in some months of the war, at the peak of the war, were higher than the actual losses in combat. I mean, there are costs to how we've handled this force and our determination not to reinstate a draft and to grow it.
Let's go to some phone calls right now and start in Racine with Edward. Hi, Edward.
Yeah, hello. Good evening and to your guest. I'd just like to give you a little history of the draft. I was drafted for Vietnam at the end of Vietnam in 1972. I served till 74, honorably discharged. And it was funny. I didn't want to go to Vietnam at that time because not being afraid of being killed, but afraid of, you know, killing somebody who I had no beef with. And then President Nixon came out and said that no draftees after this certain date, which I was one of them, would be sent to Vietnam, and they'd be sent to Korea or Germany. So I decided to go, and I went to Germany. And the career men, they were so sorry to see the draft end because they were going to lose out on all these draftees that had, you know, these guys that had something on the ball coming into the service. I mean, they were their bread and butter. I mean, when I got there, they gave me an IQ test, and they sent me to a school and a clerk school in Austria, and I had pretty easy doing over there. And also another thing was we had guys, you know, that would come into the service, and they were in trouble with the law, and the judge would say, listen, either you're going to go to prison for 5 years or you're going to go into the Army for 3 years. Now, of course, they're going to take the Army.
Edward, thanks a lot for that perspective. And James Bitfield, he brings up a couple of interesting points there. But the one point that he brought up early on was, the folks he called the lifers thought they were going to lose a lot of people who had something on the ball. But isn't that what the all-volunteer Army was supposed to solve?
Well, you know, back in the era of the draft, you would have, you know, an exact cross-section, hopefully, of society, because you were drafting out of society. It was all done, you know, with blinders on. So you had, you know, Princeton PhDs and sharecroppers kids serving alongside. You know, as self-selected, the draft is not like that anymore. So you don't see the kids of the elite typically in the military ranks, but, you know, they have been able to raise their standards such that there's plenty of people on the ball, but it's just as self-selected a force that comes, you know, disproportionately from the rural South and the Mountain West, as I said, from working-class families. So it's very different. It's very different from the force you had in the draft era when you had, you know, and that was part of the principle of military tradition in those countries, was that the military should reflect the breadth of society and not just be, you know, a certain segment of society. And we lost that when we got rid of the draft.
To that point, we got Dave on the line here from Lake Villa, Illinois. Hi, Dave.
Hey. Well, I'm 74 years old. I had a brother in the Second World War. I had a brother in the Korean War. I enlisted 1961, before Vietnam was going real bad. I was in Korea and Japan. I was in the Air Force 4 years. And I kind of think we should have a draft, or we should have some system where we have more than 1% of the population going. I really, you know, I had a niece who was married to a guy that got blown up, got his brain scrambled, and I really don't think it's fair sending people back and back and back several times. No, we need a draft, or we need a different system, but I don't think our politicians want to hear young people holler, hell no, I won't go anymore, and that's why we don't have a draft.
Dave, thanks for that perspective. And James Kitfield, what about that perspective? Because that gets at the heart of the matter. The people saw that in 1973. Carl Eikenberry sees it now, that idea that a very small percentage of the population actually winds up having to go and go fight.
No, I mean, I'm glad that listener called in, because, I mean, that, you know, and it, for my generation, I mean, my father served in World War II in the Marines. My mother's brothers all served. And, you know, that greatest generation, there was a sense of shared sacrifice in that generation. And I think that when we got rid of the draft and decided that we could just pay a certain small, very tiny segment of the country to go fight our wars, that you lost a sense of shared sacrifice. We didn't institute a war tax for these wars. We did. We put them on a credit card. Literally, it almost required nothing tangible from the American people to fight wars of over a decade. You know, you don't have to be alarmist to say that there's something about that that is somewhat unhealthy. So while I don't think we're going back to a draft, I'm glad your listener called in and reminded us of what used to be the ethos in this country, is that when this country got involved in wars, we would all sacrifice. That no longer exists.
So the article raises all sorts of issues, some of which we've talked about in the last few minutes here, but it doesn't really propose any solutions. Are you just asking people to pay attention?
No, towards the end, I do call out some possible solutions that people have recommended, at least partial ways to mitigate this impact. And one would be a war tax. So if you're going to go send the all-volunteer force off, make sure there is skin in the game for all Americans through a war tax. You could require, Congress could pass a law that said anytime you deploy the force for over 30 days, go beyond the War Powers Act, which they seem very reluctant to use, and say if you're going to deploy this force for more than a certain amount of time, you need congressional approval. So get Congress back in the debate about whether it's smart to use military force. I think there's General Stanley McChrystal, who a lot of people know from the former head of the forces in Afghanistan, has suggested a national service of 2 years. Maybe it's not, doesn't have to be in the military, but it'd be some sort of national service, Peace Corps, military, AmeriCorps, some sense that everyone is expected to serve, 18 to 28 age cohort. So you recapture some of that sense that, you know, John Kennedy's old line, ask not what, you know, your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So I think there are ideas out there. Quite honestly, I don't see a whole big political constituency for them. But I think given what we've learned about this force in the last 10 years, we should be thinking about these issues.
Well, James Kitfield, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Happy to do it.
We've been talking with James Kitfield, contributing editor at National Journal. He wrote a cover story called The Great Draft Dodge, Carl Eikenberry and What Americans Lost When They Stopped Fighting.